Hi, I'm Sophie, and this is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, a space where, together with my producer Fee, I talk to good friends and trusted experts on how they age well, whether it's their latest supplement stack, what's on their bathroom shelf, or a new biohacking device that really seems to work. Because for me, aging well is all about looking and feeling like the best possible version of ourselves, both inside as well as out. Remember, you can also find even more ideas and expert tips on my social channels at Dr. Sophie Schotter. I'd love you to come and join me over there too. So this is my show. Welcome along. As always, thank you so much for listening.
And this week, Fee and I are in conversation with Nadine Baggett.
Hi, Nadine. It's so great to have you on. And for those who don't know you, not only are you one of the UK's most loved beauty journalists, but you've also built up so much trust equity in this space. And what I really admire about you is your huge commitment to total honesty and transparency, which I think is still really rare. You've had an incredible career cutting your teeth in the world of magazines when magazines were huge. I really admire how quickly you pivoted to the online space and carved out this role as beauty influencer for women over 40. And if anyone listening wants to check out Nadine's YouTube channel, it's an absolute joy and packed with incredible knowledge and tips and reviews. I wondered, firstly, how has your relationship with beauty brands evolved? And especially as there's now so many brands to choose from, because I talk a lot about the need for regulation in aesthetic spaces, but I think it's fair to say there's also a lot of claims in skincare that don't necessarily stack up. And as an example, I loved hearing your thoughts on one famously very expensive face cream. Feel free to name it if you want to. I'm not going to. And I think a colleague of yours costed up the actual value of the ingredients. And it seems that the power used to be vested in the brands, but really now it sits with influencers and those with voices.
I have been in this industry 35 years, which means that I've seen most of the beauty trends come and go. And I think what happened was when I was a sort of naive, very fresh-faced graduate, I came into magazines. You're right, absolutely. They were the halcyon days of magazines. And I've said before on many an occasion, as a working-class girl with no discernible talents, i.e. I couldn't sing, I couldn't particularly dance, I couldn't particularly act or anything like that, the most glamorous option for a girl would be to work on a magazine. And we were addicted to our magazines. They were our lifeline in the way that social media is a lifeline for a whole new generation. So I went to work on magazines and I decided that the most glamorous division within the glamorous world of magazines was beauty. For me, it was the perfect blend of art and science. And my career has basically pathed the way that skincare and beauty brands have mimicked from art to science. Because when I first moved into magazines in my late 20s, it was all about the big beauty brands and we would be taken on gorgeous trips. We would be living the life that was well beyond our actual means because journalists are paid appallingly. Mm. And we would be sold the big myth about this cream will solve your life's issues. And I guess I was naive enough to believe it in the early days. And then as I started to dig deeper, and I have a science degree, so my natural instinct is to look at the science behind things. And then when I started interviewing dermatologists and skincare formulating scientists and research scientists and professors, and I began to realize that there was a lot of sort of myth and mystery and magic around beauty. And not that I want to bust that bubble, because I do believe that beauty can be magical, can be mysterious, and can be wonderful. But when you get to a certain age, you just need skincare and hair care that works. That's a problem-solving product. And for me, that journey was important. And it was essentially around the same time that the beauty industry had this revolution, mainly led, I have to say, by Brandon Truax of The Ordinary, who was the first person that said, and he was the one that followed on from that famous cream that you're going to talk about, and I will happily mention it, it's Crème de la Mer. And I have no shame in that at all. And he was actually a money man at the Lauder Group. And he told me that he basically had access to the profit and loss margin on products. And he worked out that Crème de la Mer was their big profit maker. And he basically then looked at how much each of those individual products cost and thought, actually, do you know what? I can break through the myth and mystery. I can talk about the active ingredients that actually work. I can go to ingredient suppliers and then make them available and affordable to everybody. And that was the moment that the beauty industry fundamentally changed, when he launched first Deciem and then The Ordinary. And that's when suddenly we ended this up in this world where, for you, it's completely natural to talk about hyaluronic acid or glycolic acid or whatever, retinol. But for the average consumer, it wasn't. And then suddenly he was putting the power back in the consumer's hands. And at that moment, it also was the time that I pivoted into digital as well.
I remember the launch of The Ordinary, Nadine, and I just thought, gosh, this is the most exciting thing to happen to beauty in a long, long while. And I don't even work in beauty, so it was really exciting. You're now in your 60s. Now, this has said an awful lot to people for various reasons in various ways, but I'm going to say this with the most genuine heart. You look astonishingly good. We know that you will have been asked this question dozens of times before, but for Sophie's audience, in terms of, let's call it, desert island skincare, can you give us your full list of hero products, ingredients, brands, including any investment products, but also the kind of stuff that we could pick up from a Superdrug or a Boots? I mean, are there any, tacked onto that question, also, are there any new products and brands that you're quite excited by?
Well, the one thing that The Ordinary did was it made you realise that you didn't have to spend a lot of money to get active ingredients that work. And my routine is very high-low. So it's mainly low, I have to say, in terms of low investment. So I believe that there are certain products that you shouldn't spend a lot of money on. I don't believe you should spend a lot of money on a cleanser or a moisturiser. You don't necessarily need to spend a lot of money on a resurfacing acid. Where I would say, and actually I used to say this a few years ago, and even now this is the revolution that's happening in skincare. Even now you don't need to spend a lot of money to get a really good vitamin A or vitamin C. So My routine is the same morning and night, and it has been probably for the last 10 years. So it is a gentle rinse off gel cleanser, hydrating gel cleanser in the morning. It's then I do particularly like a hyaluronic acid, even though they've fallen out of favor. I like a hyaluronic acid. I like a vitamin C serum. Then I would put on a moisturizer if needed, and then an SPF. Mm-hmm. And then at night, I use a rinse off cream cleanser. Again, I don't need to spend a lot of money. And then for me, I basically just go in with a retinol or a retinal. And I've tried prescription transretinoic acid. But for me, because I spend a lot of my life on camera, I'm very hard with compliance. I need minimum effort, maximum results. So I'd rather go slow and steady wins the race and do a really well formulated retinol or retinal. So with the exception of the vitamin C, and I absolutely do love SkinCeuticals C Ferulic, although their license for that finishes this year, it's 20 years old, and then everybody's going to be able to basically mimic that formulation. Ooh. So with the exception of that, and probably a retinal, and I do love Medicate Cristal Retinal because it's a stepped approach that you can go up from, you know, 0.01% up to 0.24%. But with the exception of those, everything is high street. It's all Curel, CeraVe, The Ordinary, The Inky List.
Really?
Products that you can go into Boots and buy. Absolutely. And I do believe that slow and steady wins the race in skincare. I don't believe in the miracle product anymore because I've tried them and none of them work.
That's so interesting. And I heard you say that Medicate's Crystal Retinol is the best on the market.
For me, it's the stepped approach. So they were the first people in the UK. They are the leaders in vitamin A technology in the UK, and they're a UK company. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a stepped approach. So you can work your way up in strength. So you can work your way up from 0.01% to 0.0. How does it go? It goes 1, 3, 6, 10, 20, 24. So you're sort of almost doubling in strength each time. Mm-hmm. However, can I just say there's an Australian brand called GoTo that now do a 0.25% retinal, which is the highest on the market. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing range in Space NK called Naturium. And I know what you're going to think, Space NK, it must automatically be expensive. Mm-hmm. But Naturium is a beautiful range. It's the one range. And I have been approached many times to create my own brand, but it's the one brand that I wish that I'd created. Susan Yara has done an incredible job on it. And it's effective and it's affordable. The Inky do retinols, The Ordinary do retinols, The Ordinary now do a retinal 0.2%. The problem is that obviously, and this is a totally separate podcast that Sophie needs to do with somebody from the EU to tear them a new one. The EU are now coming. They're now coming for our retinols, which is patently ridiculous.
Yes.
I love that I can make Sophie laugh on a cold January morning.
Sophie has the best giggle as well. So
obviously, we've just talked a bit about skincare routine, but I'd love to know a bit more about your morning routine generally. Obviously, we've talked about products, but any specific ones you love in the mornings? Obviously, the Medicate Crystal Retinol is a nighttime product. But also, what do you do in terms of, do you eat breakfast? Do you
never
exercise
eat breakfast
in the mornings?
Never.
Any specific
I barely
habits?
Exercise, so
really?
I should do. Listen, I moved house a couple of years ago. You know, it's very interesting. You gave me the option of not putting my camera on this morning, and I put my camera on, and people regularly see me without makeup on. And when I put my camera on, the most horrified I was by the state of my office, which, point I feel like I need to give you a little JPEG to drop in. I was clearing up my office rather than looking at my face, which I think speaks volumes about me. I don't really have that much vanity as a person. I absolutely swear by Reformer Pilates, Sophie. If anybody's going
it.
To do it.
Amazing.
I had a bad back all through my 30s. And I used to go and see an osteopath every week or every month or every 6 months, depending on how often my back went. And he said to me, you can keep coming back to me, Nadine, or you can get off your lazy backside and actually do Pilates. And Reformer Pilates is the original form that was used to rehab World War I injured soldiers. And it's amazing. And if you can get a one-on-one Reformer Pilates, it's prohibitively expensive. I'm so sorry. But that's where I would choose to do my exercise. I just have done it since I've moved. I use a rinse off gel cleanser, and I'm not particularly fussy about it, but if I'm going to choose one from the high street, it would be something like CeraVe Hydrating Gel Cleanser, and I do think it's their best cleanser by far. I think they've tweaked with that formula, but really it's just a great one. If you're going to go a little bit more high end, I really love the Fresh Amino Acid. I love an amino acid based gel cleanser in the morning. Just because I'm in the shower and I like to wash my face really quickly, then hyaluronic acid, I particularly like a couple, but I particularly like the Niad multi-molecular hyaluronic acid because I do think you need multi-molecular hyaluronic acid. And I like it because I don't believe in neck and lip and chest and eye products particularly. I do believe that any serum you use on your face, you should be able to use everywhere. And I can use that all over. And it's particularly good on my problem areas, my eyes, and it's particularly good on my crepey fine skin. So it does instantly plump. Then I go in with a lovely vitamin C, and then I go on with probably most of the times I would maybe use a peptide after that. See, again, I'm talking about active ingredients. So I love number 7, Future in You, because it's 2 unique proprietary peptides. Then a moisturizer. I probably use the Inkeyless Bioactive Ceramide Repair Moisturizer, and then an SPF. Do I use an SPF every day? No, I don't use an SPF every day, which is very contentious. Mainly because a lot of the time I don't actually leave the house. It appears that I have a very glamorous life, but a lot of the time I'm stuck at my desk creating content. I'm in a really darkened room. And also, I feel that for me, I can hear Sophie deep breathing. She's horrified by this. I absolutely have accepted the fact that I've done a lot of sun damage to my skin through sunbathing, which was ridiculous in my teens, 20s and 30s. But I absolutely, the things are my biggest regret are sunbathing and not using an SPF for 9 months of the year. There's 3 months of the year that I'm locked away and it's wintry. So for example, we just had that horrible cold patch of weather where it was snowy. I didn't wear an SPF for a couple of weeks. I barely left the house for a couple of weeks. So I'm temperate in my attitude to SPF and I don't judge people because I've been there. And I get it. And I also think it depends what you want SPF for. For me, at my age now, I actually want my SPF to prevent myself getting skin cancer because I would be at high risk of skin cancer, especially basal cell carcinomas, because I sunbathed through my 20s and 30s and 40s. I'm not the generation of buttoned up people that thinks they're never going to age and that by wearing an SPF 50 every single day, they're not going to age. Because aging is not just about skin aging. It's also about fundamental differences to your skull and your different layers within your skin. And SPF is not going to prevent that. Sorry, it's not. So I've accepted the fact that I'm 63 this year and I am going to age and it's a privilege to get older. And I don't sweat the small stuff anymore. I worry much more about skin cancer than I do about a new pigment, patch of pigment that I can get lasered off.
So what about in-clinic treatments and so-called treatments? What do you have, if anything? What do you rate, if anything? And yeah, the same question in reverse. Have you had any treatments that haven't gone so well? And again, I know that like Sophie and so many other peers, you're pushing hard for regulation in this space.
Absolutely. Do you know, it's, and Sophie will have used this term, I'm sure, many a time. It's a Wild West out there, especially in the UK. And I don't think the government going to do anything about it because I think they're too busy firefighting at the moment to even think in the long term about regulation. They've got to sort out the victim schemes and the post office, and they've got to sort out the winter fuel allowances. It's so far down the line that they can't think about it. It's a very privileged space to be able to think about the few people who are having bad treatments, and that includes me. I used to be probably about 15 years ago, so I didn't have Botox until I was 43. And that's not because I was in any way disparaging about having treatments, but they simply weren't available when I was growing up. They weren't an option. So I was one of the first people probably in the UK ever to have treatments, which is probably 20 years ago when they were first available. And I've seen people have quite cutting edge, weird treatments, and I've seen them go wrong. So what I tend to do is there are probably about 5 journalists in the UK that are the first people to try every single treatment, and I let them go first and see if they go wrong. They're my human guinea pigs. I have been burnt with IPL, and I still have the track marks on my chest and on my legs from being burnt by beauty therapists doing IPL, and I don't think beauty therapists should do IPL. I've had Spock eyebrows from bad Botox. I've had fat necrosis from high intensity frequency ultrasound. So if it's happening to me, what's happening to the other people out there? So I trust very few people to actually do any work on my face. And if I was to choose only 2 treatments moving forward, maybe 3, I would choose Botox without a doubt. Neuromodulators, I shouldn't call them Botox. That's obviously a proprietary name. But neuromodulators, without a doubt, are the biggest revolution in treatments. It seems very old school now, but there's nothing like it for erasing those stubborn lines, those expression lines on your forehead and around your eyes. I'm not such a fan of it from the cheekbones down. I think that's over-promising and under-delivering, but what it was originally formulated to do, absolutely. I would absolutely have Fraxel laser because I do think it's particularly good for people like me who've had sun damage over the years. And I would have IPL as well in the right hands because it's very good for pigmentation. So they're the 3 things I'd have. Ultrasound is not for me because I have a relatively slim face, but I have seen it work on younger women with fuller faces. I've seen it work, and I have a couple of friends who have it and swear by it, probably in their 40s and 50s. But by the time you get to my age, if you've got to the point where you're doing that thing, and again, I wish you had a camera on now because you'd see me do that thing where I put my thumb under my jaw and my fingers in my temple and I lift my face to see what I'd look like with a facelift. That's what you're going to need, ladies and gentlemen. There comes a point where the skull has shrunk, the muscle layers have shrunk, the fat layers have dropped. No skincare in the world is going to lift that. No matter what they promise, you're going to need to go under the knife. And again, all strength to you, if that's what you want to do. Absolutely, I will probably. Having said I'm not vain, I will probably have a facelift at some point.
I was going to say, I'm not sure what order Sophie's going to release these in, but we have already interviewed Mark Pacifico, an incredible...
I think I would probably have either George Ophanoitis or Mark Pacifico do my facelifts. I think they are at the cutting edge. I met Mark Pacifico at a safety and beauty event and just was very charmed by him, instantly followed him and thought, this man knows what he's doing. Very much so. I do like his work. I think if I won the lottery tomorrow, I never do the lottery. That's a ridiculous thing to say. I would go to America and probably have a facelift. I do think their surgeons probably are a few years ahead of ours. But in terms of Mark and George, I think they're the closest to what you can get in LA.
I think there's some great surgeons over here now. But as you say, the kind of facelift super surgeons, There's more of them in America.
I have a friend that's just gone to one of the facelift super surgeons in America. And again, I will not name his name, but he's a very big brand founder. He sold his brand. He sold it a couple of times now and made millions. And he's just paid $216,000 for a facelift with upper and lower bleph and a tweak of the nose. And I have to say, it's very hard to do it on a man and not feminize a man. And the work is superb.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I'm always really interested in other people's approach to so-called problem areas. So bags under the eyes or wrinkly necks or sagging jaws. What would be your approach to any of these, whether products or treatments? And obviously you've just touched on your view on at a certain point and that, you know, nothing's going to give what a facelift can, which I completely agree with. So I'm curious about what you think about those problem areas in between.
I had a lower blepharoplasty when I was 37 and I had it internally, so transconjunctivally done with laser. And I had it done because I was on television and I have all my family over for Christmas and I'm not sure obviously when this is going out, but in terms of when we're filming it, it's mid-Jan. And I looked at my entire family and it was hereditary. I even look at my lovely little 2.5-year-old great, what is he? So he's my niece's son. So I'm his great aunt. And I can see the little puffs of pads of fat under his eyes, even at that age. And then I look at my mum and my sister, who've obviously not had it done. And it was the best thing I ever did, without a doubt. And what happened was I would turn up this morning. So one of the things we haven't touched on is that I, through my magazine work, ended up doing television 25 years ago. And I would see the makeup artist click that concealer pen and desperately try to paint out these pads of fat under my eyes.
There was absolutely the
worst thing to put on as well, because it highlights it. But basically, there's nothing you can do about them. It was the makeup of my face. And I had them taken away, and it absolutely gave me back a normal contour under my eyes. So it was a prolapse pad of fat. And no skincare in the world is going to work on that. So now, as a result, that's what I talked about. I now have crepey skin under my eyes. I'm fine with that. I would rather have the crepey skin and the slight hollow than I would have the pad of fat, because it's much harder to actually get rid of. So that's why I'm pro-surgery. I interviewed somebody, at the time I was working for the Daily Mail, I interviewed somebody, and he was one of the first people to do laser transconjunctival blepharoplasty. And he just said to me, I was the perfect candidate. And at 37, you are the perfect candidate, because you take the pad of fat out and the skin just shrinks back. And I was on holiday a week later. It was truly amazing, which is why I'm very pro-surgery. So I do think upper and lower blephs are probably the first thing to do if you've got to the point where you can pinch that lump of skin over the eye and it doesn't go back, or you've got that. Well, I always say, if you wake up in the morning and your eyes are puffy and then by 10 o'clock or 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock it disappears, that's fine. That's a lymphatic issue. If it's still there when you go to bed, then it's not. It tends to be a prolapse fat issue. So I'm definitely pro those sorts of surgeries. And the amount of celebrities that have had them to open their eyes is incredible. If you suddenly see somebody with a fresher open eye, the chances are they've had that. So that's why I'm very open about the surgeries that I've had. And I do think there comes a point, if it's structural, where you need surgery. In terms of eye creams, to this day, again, I'm not particularly a fan of eye creams. I do think they oversell and underdeliver. But I do think that if it's got a specific ingredient in it, so for example, if it's got caffeine in it, it's particularly good for getting rid of under eye puffiness, because caffeine is obviously a vasoconstrictor and it works very superficially under the eye. And I do think some of the eye creams that have got the light reflective particles in are quite clever. There's also the ones that have the film formers in that instantly tighten. And guys on this morning, like the presenters on this morning and guys on television love them. The problem is they tend not to work with makeup, because the minute you put oil on that film breaks apart. So it doesn't work. I think actually in terms of eye creams, and if you are going to do anything, you're going to create something on the neck, there is still a gap in the market for a product that actually delivers, even if it's temporary. I think that's probably the cutting edge of skincare science. That's where things need to go now.
Mm. I do think there's a couple of neck creams that do deliver now, but I think necks are intrinsically such a challenging area. They're so complex. And as you very rightly said, with skincare, we're treating skin. And so much of aging concerns with the neck go deeper than skin.
Yeah. One of the regrets I have, actually, even as a beauty editor, we constantly wrote about the fact that your skincare started at your hairline and went down to your nipples, which is exactly where it should go on a day-to-day basis, and the backs of your hands, because they're the areas that are most exposed. I stupidly took it down to the base of my neck, and why didn't I take it any further? I'm relatively flat-chested, but I do like open necks. I don't like high necks. So my main area of sun damage is actually the area from the clavicle to the nipples. That's my main area of sun damage, because I like quite low tops. And that's the area I actually have most treatments. That's the area where I've had the skin boosters and the IPL. That's where I was burnt with an IPL machine. But that's the area where, you know, I want to go and see Professor Faraz at the Tutu Clinic and try and tackle those areas of sun damage, because it is very noticeable, that crepey skin. I think the alternative would be to have an implant and then it would stretch all that skin back out, but I'm not going to do that. But that's the area of sun damage. And there was a very famous beauty editor who's a very similar age to me, called Jo Glanville Blackburn, who's semi-retired now. And she was a redhead and she never went in the sun. And she had the most beautiful décolletage you've ever seen. It was pillowy and soft and white and gorgeous. And mine was, you know, I'm that typical sort of in the south of France in a white thorn bikini when I was 18, desperately trying to use my virginity sort of person. I was that sort of skinny girl in the Ombre Solaire SPF 2 thing. And I do have that skin that now shows that. I'm lucky on my body, it's not too bad, but my chest is my area that shows the most sign of sun damage. And that's my own fault, totally my own fault, even though at the time, We didn't know it was dangerous. And beauty companies told us SPFs just sold us SPFs just to wear on holiday. And we were given presentations. There was a famous man called Dr. Daniel Mays, who I adored. He was one of the first people ever to give me scientific presentations at Lauder. And he used to come and present the SPF presentation, probably in around March time. He would come, April time, because that's when we would be writing our high summer issues. And he would have a permatan because he'd just spent 3 months on his yacht in Catalina. We didn't know any better. We really didn't.
So do you want to mention a couple of neck creams that you would endorse?
Yes, because I'll try them, Sophie.
So there's one by a brand called Skin Better Science called Techno Neck Perfecting Cream. And this one's really clever because it has a proprietary complex that boosts the levels of nitric oxide in the neck skin. And the neck, compared with the face, prematurely loses its nitric oxide. So you're essentially boosting the microcirculation to the skin. And so you get more oxygen delivery, more peptides, more everything that your skin needs to be healthy. So I really rate that one. And I also really like Revision's Nectifirm Advanced. And that one's also got a very mild lipolytic activity. So it can also help to reduce the subcutaneous fat layer. So it's a clever product.
Right. Thank you.
I still think at the end of the day, though, you just need to take all your skincare down your neck. And that includes your SPF, ladies. But basically,
absolutely,
your vitamin C, or your retinol. I mean, I know there's an issue because the neck skin is quite fine. But actually, my neck and my jawline aren't too bad. It's my chest that needs all the help from people like Sophie out there. All the lasers, all the machines, all the skin boosters, everything.
Throw the lot. What about gadgets?
Yeah, throw the lot at it.
Are you into beauty gadgets, including any of these fabulous new hair dryers and straighteners?
This is not the time for me to moan about my hair, but my skin is relatively low maintenance. And I think that's because I know what I'm doing and I know how to look after it now. And also because I'm lucky, I've never had acne or psoriasis. I've had perioral dermatitis as a beauty editor, but that's not that unusual and I know how to treat that now. My hair is my high maintenance area. I suffer from female pattern hair loss through the hairline, which is not surprising. Even though I'm on HRT, I take relatively low doses of HRT. So my hair is high maintenance. It's very fine. It's prone to frizz since I've gone grey. The texture's changed, even though I colour it. And I cut it myself. I don't have any problem saying that. I'm a frustrated hairdresser. So actually, I spend a lot more money and time on my hair than I do on my face. I'm a huge Dyson fan. I absolutely love Dyson.
I love Dyson as well.
And I think I love Dyson because they are formulated to be maximum power, minimum heat. So they're particularly good for my hair. And I swear by Living Proof 5-in-1 cream. I love the Philip Kingsley products. I love their flaky, itchy scalp shampoo because I am prone to dandruff, although less so postmenopausal because I have a less of an oily scalp. And I love the Philip Kingsley lipid hair oil as well because I have to tend to have crunchy hair. But I finally realised that you need to get to a point where, just as you do with your body and you realise you're never going to wake up and be a supermodel, I'm never going to wake up and have that thick, gorgeous cheerleader hair. So I keep it at a certain length. I colour it every 3 weeks. I look after it. I use a lot of masks on it. And I'm tempted to try the minoxidil route, but I'm wary of the minoxidil route because once I try it, I can never stop it to try and grow my fringe a little bit thicker. The back is absolutely fine. It's that typical female pattern hair loss that a man gets when he gets the receders, as we call it, on a man. And I've got those areas and they are the bane of my life.
There's actually an amazing genetic, so a DNA test available called Trichotest, which involves a little cheek swab. And it can tell you whether, for example, you mentioned minoxidil, whether that's actually going to be good for you, whether it will work.
Do you offer it in your clinic?
We do, yeah.
I'm going to pop by. We're going to film this one because I need those. I can tell you, my father had very thick Eastern European hair, but even as he got older, he got the classic receders. My mum has very fine, very thin hair, and she has had, I seem to recall, most of her life, but certainly post-menopause. So she had a hysterectomy at a very young age, and it definitely affected the quality of her hair. Ironically, my sister has really thick, gorgeous hair, and so does my niece. So I can pretty much guarantee that I lost the genetic lottery on that one, but I won it on my skin and my body shape, so I'm fine with that. Small price to pay. We can't win it all.
So we know, obviously, what you said about exercise, that you're not all that into wellness as such, but what about supplements? Do you take any vitamins, any nutritional supports? Do you take a collagen or a protein powder?
I always used to take supplements sporadically when I was the worried well. Sort of, you know, you work in magazines and whatever health are, because I wrote health for 20 years as well. So I was always, whatever I was writing about, I was thinking, I'll try that supplement or I'll try that magic ingredient. It was actually my hair that triggered a proper nutritional analysis, because I went to the Philip Kingsley clinic with a friend of mine, and I had various different health issues post-COVID. My IBS came back very badly, and I'd suffered from IBS through most of my 30s and 40s, which a lot of women in my industry do, because we have quite high stressful jobs. That was my main health issue growing up. I had very bad period pains and very bad IBS. So I obviously collected my stress in my gut. And yeah. I went along with a friend of mine because I had this female pattern hair loss, but I didn't know I had female pattern hair loss. And the trichologist said to me, "What about you? What's going on with the front of your hair?" Anyway, she sent me off to the doctor's laboratory, and I had a full hormonal and nutritional panel done. And my nutrition was not good. So I had a very low B12, very low vitamin D, and relatively low ferritin and iron. So I think that was related to the IBS, but I think it was also related to the fact that I actually don't eat red meat. I gave up red meat when my father was diagnosed with bowel cancer at the age of 63, and my mother, in fact, has also had bowel cancer. So I have a big family history, and I thought the quickest thing I could do, I don't really drink that much, I don't smoke, I'm just going to give up red meat. So I eat chicken and fish, but I don't eat red meat. So I instantly then, at that point, I actually do have B12 jabs now. Not that I have the intrinsic factor, but I obviously do have a problem absorbing B12. And I take iron and I take vitamin D now. And at night, I take a magnesium supplement to help me sleep since I went through the menopause. And I obviously take my HRT. But I'm not a blind supplement recommender. I just don't believe. I think if we are concerned about the overselling, under-delivering in the aesthetics industry and the beauty industry, the wellness industry outstrips us by far. The snake oil out there is truly shocking and appalls me, genuinely appalls me. And the amount of influencers flogging complete and utter rubbish and lies in the wellness industry, and the fear-mongering and scaremongering, is truly worrying. So basically, my recommendation, if you can afford it, is to go and have a nutritional panel if you're worried about being lacking in nutrients. Now, if you're incredibly privileged like me, you can go to an aesthetic doctor or you can go to a trichologist. If you're not, go to your GP, tick the boxes, say your hair's bad, your skin bad, your nails bad, you're tired, whatever it is, go and get a full blood test if you can on your GP, but don't then rely on the GP to analyze it, because they will be looking for very low markers of disease prevention, and that's not what you want. You want somebody to analyze them who is looking for optimum levels for skin health, wellness, whatever, sleep, whatever. So I get probably at least 20 followers a day on Instagram saying to me, "But I just need the supplement that you take," and it's not that simple. It's not the same supplement for everybody. So I do take supplements. I swear by my supplements. I will never stop taking my supplements. The B12 jabs have been revolutionary for me. I felt like I was wading through ice cold water every morning. I had zero energy. So as a result of having very low iron and D and B12, I had very low red blood count. So I was essentially just continually feeling miserable and awful. So I do know that a supplement can make a difference. It's just that the same supplement for me, sadly, is not the same supplement for you, Fee, or you say Fee, or whoever's listening out there. So there's no quick fix. That's the problem.
Yeah, great advice. Now, we know we can't keep hitting you up for too much knowledge, but on the makeup front, because we haven't covered makeup, just to keep it really simple, can you give us just two or three foundations that you think are reasonably foolproof across various ages and coverage?
So what you need is you need a hydrating velvet finish foundation that has a good range of shades. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say that probably the two would be, I mean, if you've got the money, go for Armani, because essentially they come from the L'Oreal group. L'Oreal own Armani, L'Oreal own Lancôme, L'Oreal own L'Oreal Paris, L'Oreal own NYX, L'Oreal own Maybelline. So if you're a very smart beauty consumer, you look at the big power groups and you realize that they share labs, they share factories. So if you can't afford Armani, and there are various different coverages, but I do think the silk one is beautiful. And it's the one that's most often used by professional makeup artists.
It's my personal favorite as well.
It's beautiful. If you can't afford that, go for L'Oreal Paris True Match, because it's essentially almost the same product, she said, just pulling back from being sued. Almost the same product in a much more reasonably affordable price. And the shades are incredible. I think there's 42 shades now. So they would be my two. On a personal level, now bearing in mind I am a fairly average coloured skin person for the UK, I use Arboreum BB cream and I love it. And it has skincare properties and it has a really light velvety finish, which is flattering for most skins. If you're sort of my age and you're beginning to feel that your skin surface is a various mix of sort of dips and highs, so you're less worried about the lines but more concerned with under eye darkness or shadows or something like that, it has a beautiful light reflective pigment in it, but it only comes in 5 shades, and that's because it's a Korean Parisian range. So you get the best of Korean skincare, which I love, the best of Parisian makeup, but it's only in 5 shades, which is a shame because it's truly a beautiful foundation. But if you are one of those 5 shades, it's amazing and it's quite reasonably priced.
I was really interested to hear you say that you hate 90% of fragrances. I love fragrance. Talk to us about your life in perfume.
So I am actually, and I very rarely create fragrance content now, but I actually won my first ever award as a journalist writing about fragrance because I was a contributing editor of Marie Claire Health and Beauty, and I won something called a Jasmine Award. And I remember rocking up with borderline flu early in the days thinking I'm never going to win this because it was Vogue always won or Tatler always won. Or people look at me now and think I lived in an incredibly privileged world of magazines, but I always felt never quite like an insider because it was at the time an incredibly elitist industry. And when I won and I beat Vogue and I beat Tatler and I beat Harper's, I was completely shocked. I mean, there's a picture of me holding this award somewhere 20 years ago looking like I'd just been slapped around the face. And it was genuinely, it was a piece about the effect that fragrance can have on your mood and how it can be uplifting. And actually the research showing that fragrance obviously can be used to sell you products. It can be used, it's used in Alzheimer's treatment to trigger memories. So it's an incredibly evocative scent. Now, I don't like fragrance skincare, mainly because I'm actually a fragrance snob. So I don't use any fragrance skincare. I try to avoid fragrance skincare because obviously I suffer from perioral dermatitis, but I don't want it to impact the fragrances I love. And I love fragrance and I'm passionate about fragrance and I can appreciate fragrance, but I'm actually quite triggered by fragrance. It can actually give me a headache if it's a gourmand fragrance. So for example, this is a fascinating story. I once went on a, Clarins no longer own it, but I once went on a Clarins. We often used to get invited to go to their labs. And I went to the labs and at one point had to leave the main group and go to the loo. And when I came back out, I took a left instead of a right and ended up in the angel room because they used to own Angel. And it took me about 3 days to recover. I felt so nauseated and I had such a headache. Now, I appreciate that is a genius gourmand scent that is truly groundbreaking, but it's my idea of hell. Mm. Getting stuck in a lift with somebody with wearing Angel or Poison or one of those fragrances is my idea of hell. So I love fragrances, but I love a fragrance that you'd have to come and hug me to smell. And I love very cool, mossy, slight patchouli, woody, what I call nuzzle fragrances. So I've actually got 3 here on my desk to remind me of my current favorite fragrances. So I love Molecule 01 by an incredible fragrance creator called Geyser Schoen, who's a real, if we were talking a little bit earlier about Brandon Truax, who created The Ordinary, well, Geyser Schoen is his equivalent in perfumery. He's a rebel and he just says, who says we should smell of, I don't know, roses? That's ridiculous. Let's throw the rule book out. So I love Molecule 01 and it's 100% ISO-E super. It's one single note. And it's the note that smells of clean skin and it's the note that is supposed to mimic a hormone within the skin that makes you attractive to someone else. So I love that and I often layer that with other fragrances. I love Le Labo, another 13. Mm. I love Untitled by Maison Martin Margiela. I love Silver Mountain Water by Creed, and that tells you a lot about the fragrances I love. And last year, Glossier launched 2 new iterations of You, and I think You is a very clever fragrance. They launched a white one called You Do, which is absolutely beautiful and is one of my current favourite fragrances. But you shouldn't be able to smell me until you hug me, and that's what I love. And it doesn't mean to say that I don't absolutely love Portrait of a Lady, which I think is genius. And I love, that's the fragrance I most often stop people and say, what are you wearing? And I love that.
Frederick Malle, is that?
Yeah, Frederick Malle. Yeah. Absolutely beautiful. And I love Terre d'Hommes on men. But for me, I like a fragrance that's quite subtle and won't give me a headache. Mm. It's a sort of love-hate relationship. And I appreciate the Marmite fragrances, but they're not for me. What's your favourite fragrance, Sophie? Tell me.
My personal favourite on me, but again, fragrance is different on everyone, is Baccarat Rouge 540.
Yeah, so that's probably the hottest fragrance at the moment, and it's being duped by everyone.
There's another one that I love, which you may not have heard of, called Après de l'Amour by Thomas Kosmale. Have you come across that one?
No, I don't know that.
That one is stunning as well, but I just find myself going back to Baccarat. It's tricky. Once I love fragrance, I'm very loyal.
Francis Kurjan is an absolute genius perfumer. He really is. And it's the person I love that on most that I work with is Rochelle Humes wears that, and that's her signature scent, and it's beautiful. And there's a reason everybody's trying to dupe it, trust me. So it's obviously a bestseller for good reason.
Oh, loving this list, ladies. Just loving it. Thank you so much. Nadine, can you recommend a spa or more than one spa?
Yes. I was incredibly spoiled for 20 years when I, 18 years I worked at Hello. Part of my job was to review spas around the world. In the UK, I love the Aspar Spa at the Corinthia. I think it is the most stunning spa in the UK, bar none, literally bar none. It's over three floors, so there's a welcome floor, a men's floor, and a women's floor. And the reason for that is because it's been created for the Middle Eastern market and for travellers, where obviously you need sex segregation. And I actually love women-only spas. That's where my heart is. I don't want to walk around the corner and see a man in a pair of tiny little trunks or naked. That's not what I want. I love men. I am resolutely heterosexual. I just don't want to spa with them.
Yeah.
And so I love it. And it is truly stunningly beautiful. I mean, it's the most beautiful spa I've seen in the UK. And it was designed by a woman called Sue Harmsworth, who was the founder of Aspar, who I think is the greatest spa designer of all time and is one of my muses. I think abroad, I've had so many great experiences. I once went to a spa in the Seychelles where there were bats in the trees above, and I had an outside spa treatment that was incredible. I think for me, my favourite spa treatment, and I'm not a wellness person, I poo-poo a lot of wellness, so I'm not going to do chakra balancing or vaginal steaming. I have tried them all, ladies, trust me. And I've had some amazing experiences, but my favourite treatment will always be a Balinese massage because I like long overlapping massages. And I think for me, if I can find a Far Eastern person to give me my massage, there's something in their culture that isn't jumping on a wellness bandwagon, that is so cultural to them. So if you're looking for somebody from Bali or somebody from Thailand, or they're the people that give the best treatments because there's something cultural and philosophical and spiritual about them that isn't fake. It's very authentic. So you haven't got some sort of Eastern LA guru trying to rebalance your chakras or giving you a sound bath or anything like that. I just giggle through most of those things. I can't switch off my mind.
Yeah.
Because why would I want to? That's my addiction, is being mentally active. I quite like that. But also, for me, if you're going to be spiritual, it has to be authentic. So it has to be, I don't like the Western world co-opting Eastern spirituality. Yeah. I'm uncomfortable with that.
If I'm in London or Dublin or somewhere, I'll always seek out a Thai massage place.
Thai massage is my idea of absolute hell, because traditional Thai massage is the one where they're bending you backwards and doing deep massage, which is the exact opposite of Balinese massage.
Right.
But if I can get a Thai person to do an overlapping gentle massage, I'm happy.
You're in.
Where, how do you go about finding your local Thai massage to torture you, Fee?
Well, I was in Hampstead. I didn't live in Hampstead, unfortunately, but I just saw one. I just went in. My back was hurting. And I loved the fact that it was an hour of no chit-chat, no fluff, just go in, sort my back out, off I go, 40 quid. Brilliant. Loved it.
Yeah, and it's authentic. That's what they do.
Yeah.
If you go to any Thai beach resort, you will see women lined up on the beach giving torture. Mm-hmm. That's my idea of hell. Whenever I have a spa treatment and I have a back and neck and shoulder massage or full body massage, a therapist will go to me, there's a lot of tension back here, madam.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah, leave it there because that's where it belongs. Trust me. You are not going to undo 30 years of being a journalist on a daily deadline or on a daytime live TV show. You're not going to undo that in the next 45 minutes. Leave that lactic acid where it belongs.
I quite liked hearing you say in another interview that you don't differentiate between work and downtime because you love what you do so much. And that's totally my motto. If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. But what do you like to do when you're not working?
Well, I disagree with if you love what you do, you never work a day. You work. I work incredibly hard, but I love my work.
Yeah.
And my work is fundamental to who I identify with as a person. So, for example, I chose not to get married and I chose not to have children. And I'm very comfortable with those decisions. I'm in a long-term relationship and I love my partner dearly. But we chose not to have children and we chose not to get married. I suppose it was very rebellious in the 80s. But my work is like my best friend. I'm incredibly lucky, Sophie. Who gets to travel around the world, interview experts, go on live television, sit at home, create videos? That's an incredibly privileged position to be in. And I'm very lucky to have that position and to be that person and to have, as a working class girl that struggled through university and went to a very average university and got an average science degree, I'm very lucky to do what I do for a living. So for me, I love what I absolutely love my work. I really do. And it is fundamental to my identity. But my downtime is 100% downtime. So at the weekends, I have friends who spend their whole time filling their downtime with things. Now, I don't need to fill my downtime with things because I have an incredibly busy work life. So my downtime is a box set and two cats in front of the burning log fire. And when I say a box set, I mean like a box set. I will not watch a series one episode at a time. I have to binge watch it. So in the week between Christmas and New Year and literally just over the weekend, because I don't live with my boyfriend, but he comes and stays with me at the weekend. He lives and works in London. We binge watch everything. So we've just binge watched Landman and we've just binge watched The Agency on Apple and Prime. We binge watch Slow Horses and things like that. I love a sort of gritty drama and particularly a spy thriller on television. And yeah, box sets are my idea of heaven. And it's very interesting because I'm a little bit of a Philistine. I don't particularly go to the theatre or the cinema anymore. And I used to love the cinema when I was younger. But I do believe that all the talent now works in television. So when you can get Gary Oldman or John Hamm or all those award-winning actors, I've just watched, what's the one with Kate Blanchett in, A Disclaimer. When you get Oscar-winning actors and actresses working on TV and you don't have to leave the house and you can open up a bag of popcorn and just watch that, that's my idea of heaven. That's my perfect downtime. And it is complete downtime.
Yeah, yeah. You've met and worked, Nadine, with so many incredible women and men. Are there any celebrities that have surprised you, either good or bad? And besides family and friends, can you tell us about a woman that you admire?
I'm still a little bit in awe of certain celebrities, but genuinely and generally, because I've interviewed so many of them, I realise that they're just human beings like the rest of us. I have interviewed Julianne Moore, I have interviewed Kate Blanchett, I have interviewed Helen Mirren. And I am a little bit nervous when I interview them because I do admire an intelligent, successful person. The vast majority of celebrities I interviewed, they're not the sharpest tools in the box, they're just beautiful and a little bit talented. So I get that. But so I'm very much in awe of an intelligent woman of a certain age that commands a room, especially if you don't know what you're going to get. I remember interviewing Susan Sarandon and Julianne Moore at Cannes one year. You can see that the cogs are turning behind their eyes. And I do admire that. And it keeps you on your toes. So they're the women I most admire in terms of celebrities. I once interviewed Kate Blanchett and I wasn't allowed to interview her. I had to interview her in front of a room of influencers because she would approve the influencers, but she wouldn't approve Hello Magazine, who I was on at the time. And I was a little bit nervous then. And I remember putting too much fake tan on, which shows a lot about my vulnerabilities. And literally, we look like two sides of a licorice allsort because I'm far too brown and she's absolutely white and has the most beautiful skin. Like most people who are truly pale, they have the most beautiful skin because they never go in the sun. The most impressive woman I've ever met in the industry, and I do admire women, especially working class women, that can create multi-million pound brands. That really inspires me, was Anita Roddick, who was the founder of The Body Shop. She was so ahead of her game. And what's happened to The Body Shop is incredibly sad, but I do think it was so ahead of its game. In terms of sustainability, authenticity, in terms of sourcing ingredients from seed to skin, from farm to bottle, in terms of supporting female collective farmers, there is nobody that has done as much for the beauty industry as that woman. And I think that she is still to this day sadly missed. And I think if she had survived, she would have carried that brand forward. And I think actually what L'Oreal did to that brand and various different people have owned it is incredibly sad because they didn't know what to do with it. But I think what L'Oreal have done in terms of taking those principles and applying them to Garnier and now to L'Oréal Paris in terms of recycling and refilling and that sort of stuff. It's going to be those big brands that will change the way the beauty industry is regulated and has a responsibility in terms of the environment. To this day, I think she's still sadly missed. Her and Brandon Truax, they are the two people that revolutionised the beauty industry and for the better.
Last question. What has been a huge career highlight for you to date? I know you're nowhere near done yet, and there'll be many more highlights to come.
It's funny you say that I'm not done yet, because every year when I have a meeting with my team, I think they forget how old I am and they go, right, we've got a 5-year plan. And I'm like, really? Am I going to be doing this when I'm 70? There are so many highlights. I'm incredibly lucky to have had a 25-year career in television and on radio, and to have worked for the best magazines and newspapers, and to interview the best celebrities and the best dermatologists and everything. But a really shallow moment was when I left my career in legacy media. So I left Hello Magazine. It was a very interesting moment. I'd been for lunch with a friend who'd said to me, there's a revolution coming. And she was working for Maybelline out of New York. And this was probably about 10 years ago. And she said, magazines are going to die. Legacy media is going to die. Everything is going to go digital. Everything's going to go online. And if you don't jump, you're going to get pushed. And I remember thinking that. And she said, you're going to lose your voice. And that's all you really care about, really, as a journalist, is your platform and your voice. And I remember I ummed and ahed. And earlier on, Sophie, you said that you were impressed by how quickly I pivoted to digital. My only regret is that I didn't do it sooner, because I actually knew 2 or 3 years before that I was going to do it. And I questioned myself, which is always a mistake. You want your first piece of digital content to be perfect, and nothing is ever perfect. Just jump. Even if you can't see where you're going to go, just jump is my piece of advice. And it's never too late for anybody at any age. And I handed my notice in at the magazine I'd been working on for 18 years. And I genuinely thought they'd say to me, oh, but stay on as a consultant. And they didn't. And I mean, at the time I was 50. I started my YouTube channel when I was 54. So I handed my notice in at Hello when I was 57. So I'd worked on it for a couple of years and I'd started getting an income from it, which was a conflict of interest. And they knew that. So I handed my notice in and I thought they'd have me back as a consultant, and they didn't. And again, why would you hire a 60-year-old when you can get 3 30-year-olds for the same price? We do price ourselves out of the market, but we're worth it, people, to co-opt a beauty phrase. And within 3 months of me walking out, I had signed to the biggest digital agency in the UK that represented all the most important influencers and digital talent. And I was on that famous billboard of Piccadilly Circus as part of a L'Oréal Paris Elviv campaign for fine hair. And I remember posting it on my social media feed, this incredible, it's that iconic Piccadilly Circus ad space that runs constantly. And there was the Elviv ad on it. And I was up there with all of these amazing people. And I remember thinking, I made the right decision. And to leave legacy media where you've worked for the BBC or ITV, or you've worked for NatMags, or you've worked for IPC, and you're incredibly protected, you're part of a really big company, and to go out on your own and then to realise that, even though I think the legacy media thought I was going to fail, but that I was going to succeed, was an incredibly proud moment for me. Very shallow. Also, those pictures were taken by Rankin, and everybody thinks they're airbrushed, and they're not airbrushed, I promise you. But my God, he knows how to light you in a way that blooms out all your imperfections. I have to say, let's gossip here a little bit. I filmed with Charlotte Tilbury the other day, and she walks around with somebody that just carries 2 lights with her the whole time. And when I come back in my next life, I want a person that just carries lights following me the whole time, because good lighting is the secret of looking good, people. Trust me.
Oh my goodness. On that note.
Thank you so much, Nadine. Fabulous conversation. Thank you for all the tips. Thank you for all the giggles. And I'm very much looking forward to catching up with you in person soon. For any of you who don't already, please do follow Nadine on socials at Nadine Baggett. And again, check out her YouTube channel. And if I'm right, you're also writing a book?
No, my agency want me to write a book. But okay. I keep putting it off. I keep putting it off. It's going to take me a good 3 or 4 months. And I think the reason I keep putting it off, actually, is because, as you've known from this last hour, and we've been recording for an hour now, loose lips sink ships. And I think if I tell the stories of the beauty industry that I could actually tell, and probably would, I'd probably end my career. So I better go out on a high with a book, Sophie. Thank you for having me.
And that ends this week's podcast. If you want to find out more about me and my work, or maybe book a consultation, head to drsophieschotter.com, and you can find me on socials at drsophieschotter. And again, thank you so much for listening.